Okay, thank you, Mercedes, for your home. This is that's a pretty serious spread on the table.
The cookies are dairy.
The cookies are dairy. I am, thank God, Fleishik. So there you go. Okay, here's what I want to do. The topic for tonight is Elon Musk's Jewish life on Mars. And I think what would be pretty cool to do is, and I've realized this the other two times we've had the series, is I actually want to throw it out to you guys first, just to try and think about like what might be some of the issues, right? If we were to create Jewish life on Mars, should we even create Jewish life on Mars? What might be some of the challenges that we would have? Let's start. Number one.
It says that like in Torah from the beginning that God created Earth. And like man on earth. So wouldn't it kind of be going against what, everything in the Torah by the basis of like where it started? Like,
meaning that since Hashem placed us on earth, why should we leave
like
this
in the Torah,
planet?
You know, like day one, like Hashem put this on earth. Day mm-hmm. two, Hashem put mm-hmm. this on earth. And then like, it doesn't say in the Torah about any other, like any other planet in outer space.
Well, careful. Well, let's continue with that. What day are the other celestial entities created?
I don't know.
Day one.
You guys go back to your kindergarten pictures that you made. So on day
two.
Four,
yeah.
I'll tell you a secret how to remember. I remember. I remember how you remember all this. This is very, so this is very important. It's off topic, but it's important. So day one, day two, day three parallel days four, five, and six. Day one, what's created?
Light and darkness.
No, dark,
water. No,
dark everything.
Oh,
the
earth itself.
Just said everything.
Okay, we need to learn. We actually, the truth is, I joke about it all the time, but we have to embrace it. That's it's really important because Brishi is actually a foil.
We never
for the entire
Torah. Oh yeah, we skipped this whole part.
So when I taught grade 12 Torah at Olpinah for 10 years and. As people used to make fun of us, we never get out of Gan Eden because it would take the whole year just to do the first few pregnant. But I took that as a compliment. So on day one, Or is created. Hashem says, Vayihi Or. Did you? Sorry, I didn't hear that. Apologize. On day two, what's created? Hashem separates.
Nope.
Earth and sky and earth.
Top and bottom waters. Day three, what's created?
The sun and the moon.
No, no, no.
The fish. No. Water and
right.
Land.
So now you have formation of land, which leads to trees, right?
Yeah.
Now day four, so here we go. Day one, day four, the same. Or is created on day one. Day four are the me'oros, me'orot, the celestial things. Day two, you have the things that...
How is there light and darkness without the sun?
There's just...
What?
The what?
It was good and bad.
No,
right.
Usually,
so that's like, it, so by the way, probably just an absence of dark. Okay, it's
sorry, what was it?
Choshech never created. Choshech exists beforehand, right?
Choshech
al pnei tam ruach mechavas al pnei mayim. What's the mayim? There's no mayim. I mean, that's the probably the first psukim or introduction. Anyways, it's I don't want to bog down with it because we could spend a very long time talking about the first psukim in the Torah, which is very important, but I don't want to get bogged down with it now. Make a long story short, on day four, the me'oros are created. So we know, Kayla, there are celestial entities. Right? So it's not like all we know is about this earth. We know there's a sun, we know there's a moon. We see clearly in Tanakh that there's lots of mention of stars, right? Some want to say there's mention references to planets. So it's clear that Chazal is aware of other planets. That's a given. There's many references to the Gemara to other planets. In fact, there's even a Gemara that talks about how Nebuchadnezzar wanted to fly up to heaven. You know, so there's clear, they're definitely aware. In fact, to be very honest with you, Chazal were obsessed, is probably a good word to use, with the sky. They clearly saw something very much inspirational about looking up into the sky. Think about it. Kiddush Levana, the entire, the moon plays a major role in the Jewish year, the Jewish calendar. The sun plays an incredible role, right, in the day and the night. So the sun and the moon play a very powerful role. Now, it's dangerous because there were certain people who said, oh, it's so powerful that maybe it's like a demigod. Maybe it is a god, right? So it's a danger with the sun, as we know from history, right? Ancient Greece, ancient... So, but it definitely, Chazal were very much attuned to the orbits of the celestial entities. So, but you're saying, okay, but we were created on this one. Why should we go to another one? Okay. Possibly, yeah. What else?
Maybe because, like, Israel is a really central aspect, and, like, also Gula and, like, holy places on earth. Mm-hmm. And just, like, leave it and be like, God.
Okay, so you're saying we're bound to this earth because, you know, that's what we need to be bound by. You know, this is, like, where the place is at.
Yeah.
Okay.
Also, days and, like, time works differently on different
Okay, this is me very important.
You see the sun. I was just thinking that, but I feel like you see the sun rise when you're in online. Like, you're in space.
Okay. So this is, okay, good, good. This is me very important. This is me very important. If you're on the moon, what do you... How does it work with the sun?
What do you mean?
I should have brought... There's actually...
It has to do with, like, rotations.
Right, very good. So what's the rotation?
And the mass, just so much.
What would be the rotation if you are in, if are on the moon? How would you see the sun? So you'd see 6 months of the year, you'd see the sun. 6 months of the year, you would now see the sun. Mm. If you're on the moon.
Oh, no.
So this is going to pose a major issue when it comes to
Shabbos.
When it comes to everything, right? Okay. Now I will discuss what the advantage is on Mars in a second. We'll see what the story is and how we have to deal with it. Now this becomes so. Just to clue you in the 19, I don't know if you know anything about the history of space exploration. Anyone know when space exploration really begins? There's an explosion.
The Cold War.
With NASA, very good. The Cold War. So the 1960s. There's a massive explosion in terms of space exploration. It's part of the Cold War, it's part of, you know, power, whatever the case may be. The Apollo begins to send up various, not rockets, space crafts. And finally, man lands on the moon in what year? 1968? In the late 60s, man first lands on the moon. And because of all the space exploration in the 1960s, many people, here we go, Cold War. You are correct, 1969, thank you. Oh, July 20th, we're almost there. Yeah. July 20th, it was Apollo 11, the first manned mission to the United States. Apollo was the first manned mission to land on the moon in 1969. Now, there were six other ones which were, you know, also unmanned. There are many times exploration, and because of all this incredible space exploration, everyone is asking questions in Jewish halacha about what would you do if you were an astronaut on the moon. And so in the 1960s, many conversations in Shuvit are actually mentioned about what to do. So that's going to be our starting point, how to deal with Mars. But we'll get there in a second. So very good. So we've got to figure out, are we even allowed to leave? Are we even allowed to, well, what would it be like? What's going to be a day? Good. What else potentially could be an issue? Those are the biggies. Yeah.
There's so many myths that you can't do without other people.
Okay, let's say we can build a community up there. Yeah. You know, Elon wants to build a huge community up there. Maybe we'll have its own challenges.
Maybe which
okay, which way do you daven?
Down.
Okay, down.
Why? Yeah. Why is that even a thing to want to be there?
Okay, so
there's so many benefits there.
Like what?
What are the benefits of being on Mars?
Well, the whole point of, like, trying to find out if we can have life on Mars is because, first of all, like, the environment that we're in now, it's not, like, it might not be sustainable because, like, for environmental reasons, like, or for, like, if you hear about how, like, I was just, like, I learned this right now because I was just in class for astronomy, literally, like 5 minutes ago, but, like, the sun is eventually going to consume the Earth. I don't know about the, like, how it connects with Mashiach and all that, but right. I do know that eventually the sun will consume the Earth, so I feel like stuff like this is important because eventually it's not going to affect us necessarily, these things, but it will affect other people in the future.
In like 2 billion years.
Yeah, but it's still important. It's like an advancement in science, and it's right. Something that's like, why not?
Okay, so take it. That's an important conversation that I actually want to start with. You mentioned an interesting point, an advancement in science, right? So what's the million-dollar question when it comes to research, especially scientific exploration? What's the downside with all this?
How will we prove it?
So that's very easy. No, prove it is easy. It's putting a satellite and going to orbit. That's not a big deal. But what's the major downside with all this?
Well, if someone's this is not.
Yeah.
If someone else asks a question first, then I'm just.
not I have a question. How much does it cost to put someone on the moon?
I don't know.
Forget Mars.
A lot.
We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. I think the number one question we have to ask ourselves is, and this is, by the way, in all these topics, we've tried to deal with it from a Heshkava perspective, a Halacha practical perspective as well. That's been something she's really tried to emphasize. So when I was thinking about this topic, and I was brainstorming, because I spent a lot of time in the car the last 2 days, so I was thinking about what the topics we're going to deal with, one question was, wait a second, why are we putting money into space exploration? Shouldn't we put money into...
bettering this earth.
Let's better this earth. Maybe if we invest the same amount of money in technology X, Y, and Z, maybe we could solve all these issues, or we could help more people, and we could... Right. So this is going to come down to the major question. When it comes to limited resources, where do you allocate your money? Now, that is an important question in every area. So yes, it deals with space exploration, but it's also a major area in any government. How much does every government put towards research for tomorrow, and how much help the people today? Right? Right. This is a fundamental hashkafic philosophical question. When you have limited resources, what are you supposed to do with them?
But Elon Musk is a billionaire who's made his own company. I'm not saying NASA's not involved here, but I'm saying it's possible that he wants to allocate his own resources to advance
right,
science.
For sure. But let me tell you something. Okay, so will $1 billion be enough to inhabit Mars?
No.
No chance. No. And I'm going to show you why in 2 minutes, right? This is something I discovered 2 nights ago, right? Which I'll show you in a minute. It is going to cost a lot of money, and you'll see why. You'll see why that is. But listen, it's still something that has to be taken into consideration. So number one is, what do you about limited resources? Number two, there's another question, and I think that's your kind of mention is, should we even be doing this? Should we even have life of this? You should know there's actually an opinion in the 1960s by the chief rabbi of Israel at the time. His name is Rabbi Goren. Right, Goren said, this is going to shock you. Are you ready for this?
Ready.
Mitzvot do not apply on the moon.
Who
they don't apply on the moon because the Torah says, Adama, this ain't Adama, mitzvot don't apply. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't mean you can kill somebody, but nothing, there's no Shabbat, there's no Lulav, there's no shofar, there's nothing when you're on the moon. Now, to that, there was a rabbi who responded and said, what are you talking about? This is absurd, right? And he wrote an entire treatise called Adam al Hayareach, to demonstrate how that is absurd, and he actually put it for us his own formula, which is how we know a lot of it, which is fascinating, because Rabbi Kasher, and have basically tried to argue against that theory, tried to say, well, what would it be like, what were the challenges, and how would we deal with them, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. So that's just fascinating in terms of, you know, mitzvah, what we do. Maybe we just throw in the towel and say, you know what? Just, you know, don't kill anybody. That's really all that matters, because you're on the moon, and mitzvah don't really apply anyways. That's pretty wild. Yeah. So we have limited resources. What else would be an issue with space exploration? Before we even... So there's the micro, which is how you deal with days. There's the big picture with limited resources. What might be another challenge? Yeah.
Have to even talk about doing mitzvah there if like you're putting yourself at constant risk of death.
Excellent. Very good. What about danger? Excellent. 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 Now, you're going to ask me about danger... And I'm going to I want to show you a fact that I discovered. Take a look. I want to read you something. So in the 1960s, there was a... I have to find it. Here it is right there. Go back. There's a gentleman called Milton Himmelfarb. I don't know if you know Milton Himmelfarb. Milton Himmelfarb was a very well-known Jewish sociologist. And he made a comment once at some public lecture that Jews accomplished many things, but there were no Jewish astronauts. They had a statement like that. In fact, even said in Yiddish, which I won't say we're in a Sephardic house, I'm not going to speak Yiddish, but the response was, what do you mean? Of course there's astronauts. Do you know why? Because a person can get killed out there. So a Jew go out there to space, passionate, you know. I remember, there's a funny story, my father, Avishalom, was on his high school football team, but he had to hide the uniform from his mother. Because a Jew play football, come on, you're going to get hit, you're going to get tackled. It's passionate. Jews played basketball, Jews played baseball, right? Jews did not play football. That was not considered a very Jewish sport. And the truth is, there aren't so many Jewish football players. You know, knock your head, that's not what Jews do. Jews use their heads, not knock their heads, right? And there's a lot to that. But the first Jewish astronaut was actually a lady by the name of Dr. Judith Resnick. She flew on Discovery in 1984, but anyone know what happened in 1984?
Yeah.
The Challenger. And so she was the first Jewish astronaut, and in fact, how long did I think it was only 7 seconds? Very short period of time. So 1984, I remember this very clearly. I was in grade five, and I remember leading up to that mission, it was a really big deal. And then when the ill-fated, the very tragic event took place, it really had, I remember as a kid, it really affected me.
My parents' wedding
day. Are you serious?
Wow.
No way.
That's so funny.
Wow.
They talked about the wedding.
That's so sad.
Wow.
Okay, 9/11.
You were born 9/11?
Yeah.
Wow.
Not 2001.
So there were a few other Jewish astronauts that went through. Of course, we're most familiar with the most famous Jewish astronaut. That is Ilan Ramon. The difference between Ilan Ramon and every other astronaut was he went out representing the State of Israel. And he was very Jewish. He spent a lot of time. He brought up with him a Torah, and he brought many Jewish artifacts. And that was in January of 1983. Unfortunately, that also was met with a very tragic fate on when it
injured.
And he also died.
In space?
Wait.
Yeah, in space. So you have this fun with the question of, you know, how many astronauts, you know, again, if I tell you two or three missions failed, well, there hasn't been that many. So the question you have to ask yourself is it considered too risky, too dangerous? Okay. So with that very brief intro, I want to just, I don't want to spend that much time on the introductory comments, although I think they are important. And that source number 1, 2, and 3 deal with limited resources. And I'll give you an example of where we talk about it. Number one is, it's a Mishnah in Gittin. Ein podin et ha-shvuyim yeter al kadei demehen, mipnei tikkun olam. That you do not redeem captives. There was a time where non-Jews said, listen, we make a lot of money. We take a Jew, we grab him, we can ask a lot of money in ransom in order to get them back. And so the Jewish community said, we cannot have this. Tikkun Olam, despite what many people want to use it for, Tikkun Olam basically says it makes something unjust in society. It tries to create something, fix the situation. But the problem was, it would choke the Jewish community. We know that Pidgin Shvim is a very important mitzvah, but if all of a sudden the non-Jews realize that we're willing to pay an unlimited amount of money, that is actually very destructive. And so the Jewish community's mission said, here's the price, take it or leave it. If you're not willing, we're not going to give some astronomical number. There's a very famous story about Rutenberg, who was kidnapped, taken prisoner, and he wrote a letter. He says, absolutely do not redeem me. I'd rather die in prison than choke the Jewish community financially. So this was something which unfortunately did take place over many years. And we see here, like, you have limited resources. You can't just spend money. And number two, something that I'm sure you're probably familiar with is, it's in Gemara and Megillah, says, Ein mochrin, right? Amar Rabbi Yochanan Mishum Rabbi Meir, Ein mochrin sefer Torah, ela lomo Torah. If you own a sefer Torah, you can sell it if you want to learn Torah, or velisi yisha, to get married, shmamina, Torah b'Torah shaper d'mei. Dilma shani Talmud, shatalmud v'yamayse, yishanami lo t'hibirei l'shevet yitzara. So we see from here, the Gemara actually says that to get married, to have a family, and anything related to the family, later on the Gemara, the poskim will say, you can even sell a sefer Torah and a shul to build a mikvah. Because anything has to do with building a family takes priority over anything else. And so this is one of the sources, you know, to get married, how important it is. So again, limited resources to sell a shul or a sefer Torah, and you're talking about, quote unquote, squandering billions of dollars in space exploration. Do you know how much good you could do today, tomorrow? Forget about 100 billion years from now, 2 billion years from now, about the sun exploding. How can you talk about something that's going to happen a billion years from now, and 100 million years from now, when people are starving and need something for tomorrow? Okay, and we see from here, number 3, Mochrim, Beit Knesset, V'chen Shor, V'rim Shepuktusha, Afilu Sefer Torah, Las Pikam, Talmidim, O Lehasi, Yatomim, B'dmav. You sell a shul, or anything of sanctity, in order to ensure that you have, that people could learn Torah, or if need be, people who are orphans. And this is really, really important, that we take our money Seriously, this priority in money, priority in stock, and what you're supposed to do. So again, I don't have an answer necessarily. And first of all, no one's asking me, right? There's no one's asking about, you know, hey, Rabbi, what do we do? Do we do special exploration? So I don't know the answer to this. And you have to really argue, you know, this is a major question. How much you allocate for, by the way, this is also true about buildings, right? If you want to build a building, it's going to cost you $20 million. Yeah, but what about your teachers aren't getting paid? And what about your resources? And what are you going to do with all that, right? But these are all these major questions that organizations, governments especially, have to deal with. This is a major issue, especially in the state of Israel. They deal with this all the time, and not surprising, governments rise and fall on these issues, right? In terms of allocating resources. Okay, that's number one. Number two, the issue is, which is essentially just sources 4 and 5, dangerous places. The Rambam says, Echad agag v'echagod var shish basakana, roi shi Yachshil bo adam v'yamud kegon shahaita lo be'er or bor v'chatziro bein sheish b'mayim. There's no water. Chav lasod lehem chuli agvos ratzvachim. If you have anything dangerous in your house, you need to put something preventive. You need a wall. You need something else that no one gets hurt. Dangerous. It's dangerous. And anyone know the halachic definition of something which is dangerous? Well, everything's dangerous. Isn't driving a car dangerous? Isn't crossing the street dangerous? Isn't going to Ryerson University dangerous? Yeah. Right? Everything's dangerous. So then how can you... So what's the answer?
You can find a way to prevent it.
So again, I wear a seatbelt. But you can't tell me that people don't die in car accidents. More people die in Israel from car accidents than from terrorist attacks. Because they all think they're like tank drivers or something, right? Yeah. But why is it that we don't say it's usher to drive a car? To cross the street? What's the answer? The question need is a interesting word to use. There's a better way to look at it. It's true that you need to.
From it, I think. Why not? If we never like tried it and everyone else did, then we wouldn't learn.
So this goes back. Remember who was there last week? You guys were there last week. So last week we discussed the idea of testing, right? Mm-hmm. Testing. So the question is, what's considered risk? 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, 100,000, right? At some point, Tom, you have to say it's enough. Because of testing for genetic diseases. So that's also true when it comes to risk. Yes, people die in the streets. What are the odds? 100,000? That's considered not risky. Meaning, do people do it? Yeah. If people do something regularly, it's not considered risky. People drive cars. That's not considered something which is dangerous. Is there a risk? Of course there's a risk. But the halacha isn't the allowed to take risks. The halacha can't do anything dangerous. And that's not considered dangerous. What? So drugs are dangerous, so they'd be awesome.
Yeah, but you're saying
if everyone does something, so should we wait until like space exploration becomes normalized and then we could do it? Like,
so that could be, perhaps, maybe, if once it becomes normalized. Yeah. Interesting. Look, anything which is dangerous to a person, there's no question, drinking too much alcohol is for sure, sir. It's dangerous, right? Drinking, too much alcohol, of course, is something which is dangerous, right? So that would be forbidden to do. For sure. Anything that involves something dangerous would be problematic, right? So the question is, what's considered risk? So, you have to assess that, right? That's why you have insurance companies. And that's why you have, what's considered risky, right? So insurance companies are willing to, insure cars because it's risky, but they know the odds of getting an accident totaling a car, and God forbid a serious injury, which is going to cost millions of dollars, is so small. So they're willing to take on that risk. Actuary science. Okay, so that's essentially how we look at halacha. And in fact, something very interesting. And source number 5, Rav Moshe was asked a question, which I like this question, it has to do with it. He said, are you allowed to play Zrikat Kadarim? Can you play basketball? Or is it too dangerous? Because he says, you play basketball. How many people here are going to play basketball? Sprain your ankle, break your foot, broke your finger. There's no one who's played basketball who hasn't had some type of injury.
But that's not the end of the world.
So if Moshe finds, he says, yeah, okay, it's dangerous, but people do it. I mean, it's not like, can people die from the basketball? I guess you could die. But he says it's risky. By the way, what's important here is that even if you do something which could break your leg, that's considered dangerous. Meaning, if you do parasailing or something, that could break your legs doing that, could be considered dangerous. So it's not just death. It's also, broken limbs, which also considered serious enough. What was that? Jumping rope, right. But anyways, he concludes something which I think is very interesting, that he says, yeah, but what about if it's your parnassa? He says, if it's your parnassa, I'm more willing to listen. Because you need firefighters, and you need police people, and you need ambulance drivers. So when it comes to a parnassa, and he actually deals with, what about animal hunting? He says, if you need to hunt for animals, if you're trapping, the whole question, that's supposed to be Jewish profession anyways, but on the side that says you're allowed to do it, it's dangerous. You're hunting down, you know, tigers, lions, and bears, oh my, right? So it's dangerous, but nonetheless, but you're probably not saying my principle. Okay, those are the side questions I just wanted to throw out there. I think they're important. Okay, here we go. Should we go there? Source number 6. Hashemayim shemayim l'Hashem. Va'aretz. Not down the finale, though. Maybe one could argue, yeah. Listen, just stay here. Aretz, Natam, Vini Adam, don't start going to Shemayim. Let Shemayim be God's dominion in God's area. So the question is, it's a nice pasuk. I don't know if it's necessarily like halachic per se, but there are those who really say, listen, stick to the earth. Don't start flying into outer space. Interesting way of looking at it. Not sure that it's necessarily followed, but I think it's an interesting thought that, you know, how do we understand Tehillim and what's the message there? Unclear, but there are those who want to argue that you're forbidden to go into space travel because you're supposed to stay on Earth, not into heaven.
So yeah. They also not fly planes?
Oh, so very good. So here's the difference. What's the difference between a plane and space travel?
Well, plane, your destination will always be on Earth.
Right. The question is, where are you going? Another thing, you're still in Earth, right? You're still in orbit Earth, right? So that's why I wouldn't take this pasuk that seriously for this topic, because you're right. You know, what's Shemayim? Is it the sky? Well, how do you climb a mountain in the sky, right? What exactly does that
entail?
Yeah.
Earth is
right. So when
the sky is still part of the Earth.
Right. So the question is, does this really mean Earth, right? How do you define what's Shemayim? Right. What's heaven? Also, it's heaven.
Hashem's in Shemayim.
Right. Very good. So if that's true.
Abounding.
By the way, Shemayim comes from Shemayim, right? There's the water. That's the water from above. So is that really referring to the clouds? It can't be clouds. Is that referring to Mars? I don't know. Is it above Mars? You know, like, I have to imagine, is Shemayim really referring to the sky? What exactly is Shemayim? That's something which is unclear. Is that necessarily orbit? Is it the moon? Or Shemayim past that? So that's what I'm saying. That's why it's unclear. Okay. So this question comes up not just because of the 1960s, but in fact comes up many years earlier. There was a fascinating case in the 1900s. You don't have it in front of you. In the 1900s, there was a young man whose father was a very well-known rabbi. The rabbi is Rabbi Simcha Halevi Ben Berger. And his son, shall we say, was not your typical rabbi son. He wanted to be involved in very interesting business endeavors. And he said he wanted to go to Norwegia, to Norway, Norwegian areas, up there in the north, and get involved in trade and business. He said it's a great opportunity. But he realized there's one problem with moving all the way out there. And that is...
Shabbos is really long.
When does Shabbos end?
Doesn't that happen like Alaska?
That's right. So this begins already in the 19th century. They realize there's something very funny that takes place in the north. You don't have to go to the Arctic Circle. You can just go to Oslo, and you can go, of course, in Anchorage, Alaska, of course. But of course, we know, and this is what it comes into, the Arctic, the poles. Because if you're in the poles, you're in a very fascinating situation. Because you have a situation where it's 6 months of dark and 6 months of light. So what was Shabbos? What's day two? What's day three? What's day four? How are you supposed to deal with that? So in many ways, space exploration uses, for all intents and purposes, no one ever talks about Antarctica. That's like no one goes there, right? Everyone talks about the north. What do you do? So there was a young lady who went to Ryerson, and she was actually going to... very close to the Arctic. And she asked me a question, what do I do about Shabbat? I had some students who were older, already in their 30s. They did a bachelor's party in Iceland, or Greenland. Iceland. Where's like the Gulf?
We always do this, oh my gosh.
Iceland has the big Gulf. They went to Iceland, right? Iceland is green and Greenland is ice. So went to Iceland, which is incredible golfing. And the problem was, when does Shabbat end? Because it was the summer, and it's not. And I'll explain what I mean by that in a second. So that's another area where we have to deal with space exploration. What I want to show you before we can even continue is a video that I found that's going to give us, I think, a lot of insight into Mars. Actually, I meant to do this earlier, and I forgot. That's what we're going to do right now. But this is specifically having to do with Mars. I think you're going to find this very interesting. Which my volume is all the way up. Here we go.
We want to go to Mars for the spirit of exploration, to create a backup location for humanity, possibly to search for additional resources, or maybe just because it's hard. Elon Musk stated that the goal of SpaceX is to help humans get to Mars. They're designing rockets, landers, and equipment to support that. Musk would like to build a Mars colony with 80,000 people, which is a good choice, as it's probably the second most habitable place in our solar system. Real estate should be pretty cheap, but the commute is a bit much. Mars is beautiful. It looks like a nice desert planet with winds, clouds, and ancient riverbeds. It's great if you're not made of meat and don't need to breathe oxygen. Otherwise, it's incredibly hostile. It's not much more habitable than the cold vacuum of space. First, there's no air on Mars. If you were dropped on the surface of Mars, the view would be spectacular, and then you'd quickly pass out and expire a couple of minutes later from a lack of oxygen.
That's a great video. He's super sarcastic.
The temperatures are incredibly cold. Did I mention the constant radiation streaming from space? You might also want to note that the soil is toxic. There's a long list of these types of problems. The days are a little longer. You'll be sleepy. If we intend to live on Mars and stay there permanently, we'll be leaning hard on our technology to keep us alive, never mind comfortable. In order to survive the lack of air pressure and the cold, humans will need pressurized and heated habitats. Fortunately, there's a little local support, as Mars does provide us with some raw materials. The regolith, the material which covers the surface, could be used to make concrete. And there are cave systems which could be converted into underground habitats to protect citizens from the radiation. Martians, the terrestrial kind, will need a spacesuit whenever they go outside. And every hour they spend adds to their radiation exposure and grants all the complications that exposure brings. For the long term, we'll need to figure out how to extract water from underground supplies and use that to generate breathable air and rocket fuel. And once we've reduced the risk of suffocation or dying of dehydration, we'll need to consider food sources, as we'll be outside the delivery area of everyone except Planet Express. Care packages could be shipped up from Earth, but that's going to come at a hefty price tag. We'll need to produce our own food. Interestingly, although toxic, Martian soil can be used to grow plants once you supplement it and remove some of the harsher chemicals. NASA's extensive experience in hydroponics will help, and one of the biggest problems will be access to spare parts and medical supplies. You can't just go down to the store when you're on Mars if your kidney gives out or your sonic screwdriver breaks. There will need to be a constant stream of supplies coming from Earth until the Martian economy is built up enough to support itself. One more big unknown is what the low gravity will do to the human body over months and years. Will it shorten our lifespan or lengthen it? We just don't know. To thrive on Mars, the brave adventurers may want to change themselves, or possibly their offspring. This could lead to genetic engineering to help future generations adapt to the low gravity, higher radiation, and lower air pressure. Why stop at humans? We'll adapt our plants and animals to live there as well. Finally, to take things to the next level, we can make a few planetary renovations. We'll change Mars itself through the process of terraforming. We'll need to release mountains of greenhouse gases to warm the planet, unleashing the frozen water reserves. Perhaps we'll crash a few hundred comets into the planet to deliver water and other chemicals. It might take thousands or even millions of years, but it could be possible to restore Mars to a place we could live on, even without a spacesuit. So what do you think? Would you be part of the Mars terraforming expedition? Tell us in the comments below.
Okay, so as you can see, there are a lot of challenges. A lot of challenges with going. So I just wanted to put into perspective, this is not something that's going to happen, you know, like next week, right? It's extremely, extremely challenging.
We're trying to build another world.
Right. From not nothing, but less than nothing.
Yeah.
Right? So, okay. So here we go. Back to our topic. So Mars. So how do we figure out what a day is? And this is going to be a major, major topic. Let's start like this. Number one. How would you calculate a day? If you were in the Arctic, how would you calculate a day? Well, how do you define a day? If someone were to ask you, what is a day? What would you say a day is?
Sunrise, sunset. Yeah.
So if a day is sunrise, sunset, and you're in the Arctic, and there's no sunrise or sunset, then what do you do?
24 hours.
But you just told me a day's sunrise, sunset.
12 hours.
12 hours?
No, it's 24.
What time zone would you be on?
And what?
That's like a whole day.
Yeah. Day and night.
Yeah.
Day and night together.
So.
Yeah.
What's the definition of time?
Relax.
The duration of events or the interval between them.
Then,
get out.
Also, so, space time is different.
Okay, so it is true. A day on Mars. Okay, I'll explain what this means in a second. If you want to tell me that a day is sunrise, sunset, and you're locked into that definition, then you're going to have a major problem. Because sunrise, sunset doesn't take place
in the Arctic.
And it doesn't take place on the moon, but it does take place, good news, on Mars. Sunrise, sunset, you'll see on Mars, the day is longer. It's about, not 24 hours, I think it's about, I have it somewhere in my notes, 25 or 26 hours. Meaning, that is actually not the biggest deal on Mars. So when you travel to a place, let's go through this for a second. When do we say Shabbos ends? At sunset?
No.
No, we don't. What needs to have to happen for Shabbat to end?
Stars.
You need stars. Now, is that a definition or is that just an assistance to something else that's going on?
An assistance.
Right? It's just helping us. Oh, let me give you an example. Let's say I can't see stars. The Shabbat doesn't end? Of course Shabbat ends. So what happens? So let me explain to you something really cool. When the sun sets, it's going under the horizon. By the way, how do you measure the horizon? We'll talk about that in a minute also. How far down does the sun have to go to say that Shabbat is over? Understand? That's the question. How many degrees below the horizon does Shabbat end? The most stringent opinion is a guy called Rabbeinu Tam. You ever heard of this? Shabbat ends Rabbeinu. Who holds Rabbeinu Tam?
Yeah.
It's actually not the most stringent opinion, but it's a more stringent opinion. That's 72 minutes. Where does he get that from? How did he get it from is not relevant, but it's about 16 degrees down from the horizon. The sun never gets there in many places, even on planet Earth, in normal situations. Like Anchorage, Alaska, the sun will never, ever go down that far in the summer.
But that's like, never. You know, when it ends, or that's just till Sefer Shabbos.
No, for him, it's when Shabbat ends. Now, and the opposite is true. When Shabbat begins, he'll be doing malacha, because for him, Shabbat actually only starts much, much later. It's a whole... Now, the sun going down, there are times, as you know, where the sun will never go down nearly far enough for Shabbat to end, according to many other opinions. I'll give you an example. The most leading opinion is 5 degrees. That's a shita of the Gaonim. We generally hold the prevailing custom is we have is like 8 or 9 degrees. And even 8 or 9 degrees doesn't happen in many places in the summer. Or if it does happen, it's going to be at 1, 2, or 3 o'clock in the morning. But here's the thing. You have to say the day ends because it gets to a point that it's its lowest point, and then what happens right afterwards? It begins to rise. So Sunday has to happen, right? You follow? Sunday has to begin somewhere. So this is just it is connected to space exploration, but the general prevailing custom is, well, once it gets to its lowest point that it will ever get to, is called, which actually, by the way, is Chatzot Laila, right? It's like the night, because now it's heading up. The moment it begins to head up, you can't tell me that it's Shabbat anymore, because it's heading up. The next day's actually begun. That is actually what we hold. If you ever go to these far out places, and there's a very cool website that you can actually drag I used this once. You actually drag across the screen. I'll show you it later. You drag across the screen. It actually shows you the lowest point of the sun. And the moment begins to get up, that's when Shabbat ends. You put it into your calendar. So it could be 1:30 or 2:30 in the morning. Okay. So you make Avdallah probably Sunday morning, unless you want to stay up late, you know. So anyway, that's just an aside. So if you want to tell me that the day is defined by sunrise and sunset, if you're on the moon, you're going to be in very big trouble because there's no sunrise, sunset. And if you're in the Arctic Circle, you're in big trouble because there's no sunrise, sunset. And many other places, it's going to be super duper late in the summer. Okay? Now, you'll always have sunrise, sunset. You won't have dark. You're not going to get dark. Okay? So even now, like tonight, at 10 o'clock at night, it'll be dark, but you'll still see some glimmer of light in the sky till a little bit later. Okay, fine. That's point number one. So how do they deal with that? So there's a number of different ways how to deal with this challenge. And there are those who say, you know what? You know what you should do? Very simple. Take a look at your handout in front of you. It's number 7. What happens if you're lost in the desert? Aholech b'midbar ve'eino yodea matai hu Shabbat. So you went out to the desert. You don't have your cell phone on you. And you have no clue when Shabbat is. Listen to this. Mona shiva yamim yom shenatan elibo shechachachal. You're like, I have no idea what day it is. You count 7 days. And the 7th day you say, today's Shabbat, make Kiddush, make Avdallah.
So you have to start from scratch.
Start from scratch. I have no idea what day it is today. Today's Wednesday, today's Sunday, today's Thursday, maybe today's Shabbat.
You messed it up.
Totally confused.
For sure.
Possible.
I feel like that's
totally possible. Totally could have missed it.
What's super cool about the world that we live in, this is actually pretty neat, is that everybody agrees that today is Tuesday. Even though 7 days a week makes no sense. It's not like base 10, it's not divided easily. When it comes to days of the week, there's no like different...
It's true.
Everywhere in the world, with no exception, has a 7-day week, which makes no sense.
But those are for biblical reasons, though.
The answer is, says the Kuzari, that just shows you that everyone really comes from Adam Rishon, from the Torah. Because otherwise, why would anyone create a 7-day week? It makes absolutely no logical sense. Right? And everyone agrees it's Tuesday. Again, we might call the months different. You have lunar, you have solar, but everyone from a day of the week perspective, it's pretty cool, no? Okay. So there are those who want to argue that, you know what? Let's just pretend being lost in the desert is like being out in outer space. Just count 7 days. What do you think? Good idea, not a good idea? Is that a good analogy?
You could start your own time system, let's say. If that's how it works, apparently, then why can't you just do that on Mars and start it off? Be like, okay, day one.
And then readapt your times.
Yeah.
They readapt your times.
Because, like, halakhic times have nothing to do with our, like, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock.
Right. Maybe it's just sunrise. So, again, there are those who say, forget it. Shabbat's made to be on planet Earth. You need a... Right? No. And others say, what are you talking about? Okay, you're in Mars. You got to deal with your own Shabbat. Right? We have our own Shabbat now, our own system, which might, your Shabbat could be Tuesday, and everyone else's Shabbat on Earth could be Shabbat. Right? It'd be a different day. That would, in theory, that could happen. So, if we go back to our case, the Tiferet Yisrael, in source number 10, this is amazing. He says, he noticed something in his time. You see here, there's a bracket. Wolfishia. People would go whale fishing. He says people would go all the way north whale fishing, and they wanted to know when would Shabbat be. And he says, "Mistabekina b'medina tatzvonit, way north, kemo b'irenu Danzig." He lives in Germany, right, Danzig? But what about in Copenhagen or in Strachom? Called the b'chol hashana yuni v'yuli laila kiyom ya'ir. That in nighttime it's like daytime. He says it's the middle of the night and it's daylight. If you go to places like Stockholm. Right? In the summer. I'm going to talk about in the summer. The chol adam nidon lefimo kamo v'shato. He says, maybe you go according to where you are. You know what? If this is where I am, this is going to determine what my day is going to be. So he, in fact, argues and says, no, you're not lost. That's only the case if you're lost in the desert. I'm not lost in the desert. My orbit takes off where I'm traveling to the north to go whale fishing. I know it's Tuesday. Okay. So whatever the local person, what day is it today? Well, okay, tell me it's Wednesday. Ask the people, what day is it? They know what the day is. Ask them what day it is. Right? Ask them what day it is. That's one opinion that he recommends. So what about if you go to a place where there's no inhabitants? What day is it? So he says, very simple. You leave on a Tuesday, the sun sets, and whatever that means, okay, maybe it's then Wednesday. Or he says, or count 24 hours. You left at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, count 24 hours, you know it's Wednesday. And he says, that's another thing that you can do. And he offers that as a suggestion. And he even goes so far as to say that in theory, if two people arrive from the Western Hemisphere, he says from America, right, and someone else arrives from the East, and they show up in the North and Central Europe, whatever, you could even have a situation where people have different days. Where one person thinks it's Tuesday, one person thinks it's Wednesday. Why is that? Because they each arrived, perhaps their traveling caused them to, you know,
so you're just get mixed up. Ignoring the time zones?
Yeah, for the time zones, you show up there, you create, you think for you, it's, you left on a Tuesday, it's now Tuesday, and okay, then it's Wednesday, and another guy leaves on a, perhaps on this, arrives on a different day, and he counts his own days based on when he left on a Tuesday, a 24-hour period. So he even suggests that people could be in the same place having Shabbat on different days. So that's a pretty wild scenario as well. But that's what he ends with. And he says that, you know, Mavdilin b'motzei Shabbos in Europe, which is Shachri, which is Shabbos in America. And he says that's the way it is. So okay, a very interesting suggestion of this Tiferet Yisrael that he mentions. So again, others argued and said, do you know how to deal with heading to the north? Just count 6 days of 24 hours. That could also perhaps also be a suggestion. So we have a few different posts in the 19th century and 20th century who try to deal with this challenge. I want to show you a quote, which I think is important. Number 11, the Gemara says, "Yichelki b'machnisei Shabbat in Tiberia and Motzei Shabbat in Tzipor." Let me explain. They're saying this is meritorious that you should bring Shabbos like you into Eminent Tveria. What's where's Tveria? Tveria is up in the north. And where's it located? Up on a hill. So when are you going to, why is it that it's meritorious to accept Shabbos like in Tveria? The answer is, if you're high up, what do you see? You're going to see the sun setting very early. So you're going to accept Shabbos early. And end Shabbos in Tzipor. Tzipor was in a valley. So they would end Shabbat much, shall we say, later, till the sun actually totally disappeared. So there is this idea, that, I apologize, the exact opposite. My mistake.
What?
If you're up on a hill, you're going to see the sun for longer. My mistake, sorry, You can see the sun for longer. So let's flip it around. In Tveria, they were in a valley. And Tzipor, they're up on a hill. And therefore, since they were in a valley, they'd bring Shabbat in because it would get darker earlier. And therefore, they'd bring Shabbat in potentially earlier. If you're up on a mountaintop, the sun is still there. I still see the sun. That actually falls even further down the horizon. We hold the halacha, by the way. It's actually an interesting question. What do we hold to determine? Do we use sea level? By the way, in Toronto, are we at sea level or are we above sea level? We're a little bit above sea level. So do we pretend that everyone's on the sea level? Let's say you're in an apartment building. Let's say you're on the 110th floor of a building. So is Shabbat based on what you see out of your window? No. The person on the ground floor?
The ground floor.
This has major ramifications for airplane travel. If you're in an airplane, you're all the way up here. Does it go by what you see out your window? Or does it go by what a person would see if they'd be standing over here?
The bottom.
But of which place are you coming from?
So again, I'm flying an airplane, and I'm heading from Israel to Toronto, right? So I'm flying, and my plane is here. Now, I can see the sun, because I'm flying up so high. But if I would be on Earth, I wouldn't see the sun.
How do you know where you are on an airplane, though?
Well, today, we get everything. Those little cool maps that you have,
GPS.
Right?
Yeah, but how do you know what time it is there? There's a time difference.
No, so again, there's no time. Be very careful. It's the exact same time. Think about being on an airplane as being on a very, very, very tall mountain. Super tall mountain. So do I go by what I see, or do I go by what really is happening on sea level? How do you determine Shabbat? Or do you go by the ground? So Toronto, I don't care about sea level, because we're not on sea level. We're 100 meters or so, 200 meters above sea level. So do I care about ground? Do I care about sea level? Or do I care about where I am? 110th floor of a building or in a high airplane? So we actually say we really, really, really go according to sea level or ground, either one of those. But probably not. I thought, look, we see from the Gemara. The Gemara says it's meritorious to do what they do, being on top of a mountain and waiting for Shabbat day and later. That's, I wish I could be like that. That's not the halacha, you follow? Yehi chalkei, I should be like them. So this is also going to be fascinating. We don't go by what you see in halacha, which is pretty amazing. You go by either ground or you go by sea level. I believe it is machlogim on contemporary poskim, which one we should go according to. But it's a major ramification for when you're traveling on an airplane. That's why all these crazy programs out there now, you can punch in your flight number and it'll tell you about shachar, it'll tell you about menachem arav. It's not what you see out your window.
Oh my god, I literally need it.
Yeah, you have to go in. Yeah,
is because, it an app?
No, it's a website. Take a look. Halachic Zmanim Travel. But this is a major issue because if you go to Israel, sometimes you're actually, turning on your flight path, you actually find yourself by the lower Arctic Circle. And that's really going to throw. You can actually go in and out of days and day and nights much more than you actually think. Because again, that's not what you see. It goes about what's happening on the ground. So you actually don't realize that you're jumping time. Again, you think it's light outside. You think it's daytime. But on the ground where you are, it's actually nighttime. So you have a very small gap for mincha or for tefillah.
Oh, you should take the night flight.
Right? No, it doesn't. It might not really matter, depending on the time of day.
Throws you off like 12 hours.
So, anyways, that's a, just, I wanted to throw that out there. That's, by the way, that's, so let's go back to, I'll tell you why this is a fascinating question. This is a fascinating question because Ilan Ramon asked the local Chabad rabbi, when I'm on my satellite, what do I do about Shabbat? Now, he did not keep Shabbat in the land of Israel, but he felt he wanted to keep Shabbat as best as he could in space. So what do you do? How do you keep Shabbat? So, and you know, like the famous joke about why Jews can't be astronauts? You know, like there's a famous, you know, the Orthodox guy went into orbit and he lands and he says it was a terrible experience. Every 2 seconds, Shachar Mincha Marv, Shachar Mincha Marv, all he did was daven, right? But is that really true? So if you're on a spaceship actually orbits the Earth every 90 minutes. It can orbit, you can go around, you can orbit the Earth in 90 minutes. So if that's because based on the way the Earth is spinning and the way it's going to run. So if you're going to orbit the Earth in 90 minutes, that would mean, and by the way, again, think about this for a second. If you define, because if you go by where you are on the ground, you follow the issue? Let me just do a diagram here. Carrots are healthy. I'll take a carrot. So is my spaceship. I'm going to get small. Right? And this is Earth. So if I'm going around the Earth, so now it's nighttime, right? Let's just say, and then it's going to be afternoon, it's going to be evening, you follow? Because it goes by where I really, not where I am up here, it goes by where I'm parallel to on Earth. So when I'm on this side, let's say the sun is here, right? It's daytime. When I'm here, it's going to be nighttime, right? And I'm here, it's going to be afternoon. Here's going to be a, whatever it'll be, right? So if I'm doing this very quickly, is it going to be Shachar bin Chamar, Shachar bin Chamar in 90 minutes? So this question was asked, what do you do? Yeah, that's crazy. And then what do you do about, so therefore, are you ready for this? How Shabbos would be every 90 times 7? That would be every 630 minutes is it going to be Shabbos.
How long is that? Like 10 and a half.
For 90 minutes. You're going to have Shabbos for 90 minutes. And then Shabbos is going to end. If you say, you follow, that it goes by. So this is going to be very complicated. So, if you are orbiting the Earth, you need to be aware of this. So that's, how do you do this practically? So there's no way you need to daven Shachar Mincha Maariv every 90 minutes. That's absurd. So what you'd have to do is, no, all you need to do is daven Shachar Mincha Maariv for 24 hours. Right? Because I've davened my 24-hour period. No, you can't tell me that God obligates me to daven every 90 minutes just because, well, that makes no sense. It's, no, every day I need to have these certain tefillot. So, okay, I've done my tefillah for Shachar. So however, when it comes to Shabbat and Malacha, they actually said that you should try and avoid doing Malacha for those few, for those 90 minutes every so often. Now, that's very difficult to do in space because you need to survive and do whatever planetary people do, moon, you know, astronauts do. But he said if he could avoid doing, you know, if he knew that that moment was a Shabbos moment, if he could somehow avoid doing certain melachot, that would be ideal.
Wait, every 90 minutes?
Every 90 minutes is another day. So 90 times 7... basically 56, you know, whatever, 60 equals into 56, whatever that number is, and like you guys said. So he said that's what you should perhaps consider in terms of Shabbos. So, fascinating. Now, but if you're just sitting on the moon, so you have 6 months of day, 6 months of night, there's no sunrise, no sunset, and you're staying where you are. You're only connected to one place on Earth. So then what do you do? Well, once you're not orbiting Earth anymore, you're out of Earth's orbit. Believe it or not, there are those who say that keeping Shabbat would only be rabbinic because Shabbat's all about 7 days a week and creation and sunrise, sunset and Maisa Bereishit, and that was created in a certain type of structure. You don't have that on Earth, on the moon, sorry. So you've totally mufka from that entire concept, which maybe you could apply to Mars because, yes, it's true, you might have sunrise, sunset, but like that's not Shabbat's like Earth sunrise, sunset. So there are even those who would argue that on Mars or on the moon, Shabbat would only be rabbinic to observe. Only the Rabbanon, because you're totally removed yourself from such a system. You could even argue that. But regardless, what they said was, if you're going to go to Mars, if you're going to go to the moon, very simple. You left on a Tuesday, keep it 24 hours, whatever the Shabbat is, that's what it would be, if you're on staying put, not in orbit on Earth, you're staying put on the moon. Interesting. And this, by the way, would also be true then. You could extrapolate to that. Well, the truth is, they extrapolate the opposite way. No one talks about that. Most people talk about if you go to the Arctic Circle, what do? When you have 6 months of light, 6 months of dark, that's what essentially they say is. You show up there, it's Tuesday, you know that it's Tuesday, your watch says it's Tuesday, just clock yourself off. Now, when the challenge will be, when does it start? Because when is sunrise, when is sunset, when does Shabbos begin? I know that 24 hours is Saturday, but that doesn't help me. When does Shabbat begin, when does Shabbat end? So others argue you should go with the closest Jewish community. Whatever the closest Jewish community is, you're 10 kilometers away, you're 100 kilometers away, you're 200 kilometers away, just go by whatever that community does. That's probably a good guess. That's not a bad solution. Or else you'd have to go with, I won't go by the local Jewish community. If I wanted to, I can also go by, try and figure out with my, yeah, I left at 2 p.m., I'm just going to keep to my clock and where I left from. So my city that I came from was Toronto. In Toronto, now Shabbat starts, I'm going to keep Shabbat now in the Arctic Circle as well. That would be another possibility, not close to the Jewish community, but where I came from. And I'm bound to those times, wherever Shabbat begins, because otherwise Friday, how do I figure? I know that it's Saturday, when does Shabbat begin and end? Maybe you go by what you're... So these are fascinating questions about life on the moon. Yeah, sorry.
No, Roger? No.
Okay, I think just to summarize, number one, question number one is, this whole conversation is ridiculous, such a waste of money putting into space exploration, let's put it into Jewish day school tuition and food and making sure that people, have proper, healthy, educated families and stop putting money, $100 million, into missions that most of the time don't work and will only have an impact in a million years from now, where we need to figure out things 20 years from now. We're worried about Jewish education and Jewish community infrastructure. That's number one. Number two is maybe we shouldn't even be going to these places. What are you talking about? Jews are sure. That's let you know, humans stay on Earth. There's what to do here, improve here. We shouldn't even be doing those things. That's for God to kind of deal with. And it was dangerous. So maybe it's more dangerous than normal. But you could argue also as a police officer, and that's a job, but it needs to be done. That's a necessity. Maybe it's not being necessity going to Mars or to the moon or whatever the case may be. The next conversation is, okay, now that we're going, what's a day? There's no, what do you do about sunrise, sunset? What are you tethered to? The ground where you left? Or you just count 24 hours? Or you go by where you came from? And again, these are very practical conversations, much more so in the Arctic Circle, you're probably more likely to be in the Arctic Circle than on Mars, I have a feeling. And not that anyone is going to be in the Arctic Circle either, but you have a greater chance of finding yourself in the Arctic Circle, realistically, than on Mars. Or in fact, even on the Moon. I don't think anybody has, you know. So, but again, that's very practical. And these were serious questions. And again, to bring it even more practical, if you're going to places like Oslo or to the northern, you know, Sweden, these are really serious questions about when Shabbos would begin and end. And try to figure out those halachic times as well. Again, there's easier because there's actual real sunrise sunset, which you don't have in the Arctic and you don't have on the Moon itself. And again, practically fly. That's one of the guys. So very practical flying in an airplane. Sometimes we don't even realize that we're going in and out of times that we it appears to us that it's daytime outside, but really, if I were to be, how many kilometers do we fly up in the air on an airplane?
Like 4,000.
No, we're not 4,000 kilometers, we're 4,000, no, 30,000, 30,000 feet, I think is what I always forget. 35,000 feet? It depends, if an international flight, the average airplane in the sky.
I said it in Hebrew.
How far would they say? They for sure give it in meters, no?
I said in Hebrew, I kind of checked out at that point.
That's the speed. That's the speed. It's like 800-900 kilometers an hour. But I want to know average height. God, how do people know? People actually have to know things. Now, you don't have to know anything. Altitude of a plane. Here you go. Answer is, 35,000 feet. The typical cruising altitude is 35,000 feet. So if it's at 35,000 feet, how many meters is that? 10,000. So you're talking 1,000 kilometers in up high, right? That's pretty high. You're 1,000 kilometers in the air, let's say. So if you're 1,000 kilometers, wait, does that make sense? That's way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, you're about 1,000 kilometers up high. So you will perceive day and night differently than when it actually is 1,000 kilometers beneath you. So that's where a practical example would be: is you got to know what's on the ground. Huh, right? If you have 3 feet on the ground, you have to know what the reality is. And it's also in terms of Shabbat, is that, you know, how do we calculate when Shabbat begins and ends? Zmani begin and end, it's not necessarily where you are, but maybe there's some type of objective standard, and that's called sea level, or perhaps ground level, which can be a little bit different. Especially, Toronto's is pretty flat, but if you go to a place like Jerusalem, Yerushalayim is about, I think, 800 meters above sea level, that's very different for Zmanim than if it was to be on the ground. Right? Because you're going to see it differently on the horizon. So I just wanted to throw out some halachic scenarios besides Mars, you know, try to make it a little more practical. But I think also the Hashkafic considerations, which are pretty fascinating. And I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens in the future. If Elon Musk actually gets his wish and he invests his own money and he has people to follow him,
Wait, for the first point, though,
yeah.
The whole thing was about how why would we spend the money on this? It's pointless, whatever. But what do you think people like back then would say the same thing about other space things that we've done in the past that gave us advances with
medical technology, weather
forecasting, or like other things like that? We wouldn't like before. I'm sure they didn't think about that. And they're like, well, why would we spend money on that also? But we don't know what we're going to discover.
I agree. There could be some good that comes out of it to help humanity. And the Torah says that we have an obligation, v'kif shuha, right? We have an obligation to make it on this piece of paper. But two, Hashem gives us the world. Oh no, that was last week's topic. That's where I'm the pasuk from. That the idea is that we're supposed to conquer the land. The betterment of mankind. The goal, you know, if it's about ego and power, that's a problem. But if the goal is the betterment of humankind, then you could argue that there's value, right? You know, listen, most research in the medical world will be irrelevant, obsolete, not helpful. But it's that one in whatever that can cure cancer. So, okay, we'll end there. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Definitely, definitely interesting topic.